Hello, everybody. This is Marshall Poe. I'm the founder and editor of the New Books Network. I've published several academic books, and one of the things I found frustrating is my inability to get them picked up in the press. There really is no PR service specifically oriented toward academic books. Recently, however, I had the opportunity to work with a PR firm in New York, RLM, on a book that I recently published. And I have to say, they did a remarkable job at a very low price. And this got me thinking, I wonder if the New Books Network and RLM could provide a service that would promote academic books. So the folks at RLM and I put our heads together and we came up with a package. It is specifically targeted toward people like you, people who write academic books. So if you're interested, you should go to the NBN website and click publish your book, and there you'll find some information about the services that the NBN and RLM are offering. What we really want to do is provide you with value for money. As far as we know, no such service exists. This is the first of its kind, and we really hope it is successful, and we hope that it helps you get the word out about your academic book.
Hello, everyone. I'm C.P. Leslie, the host of New Books in Historical Fiction. Today I'm speaking with William Burton McCormick, the author of Lenin's Harem, a novel that, despite what you may imagine from the title, deals with an elite Latvian military unit during World War I and the early years of Soviet power. Reading this novel was the first time I'd heard about this particular element of what the historian Peter Hultqvist has called Russia's continuum of crisis, by which he meant the entire period of war and revolution that ran from about 1900 to the 1930s. So I'm particularly looking forward to finding out more during this interview. With richly detailed description and action, Lenin's Harem tells its story through the eyes of Viktor Rooks, a young Baltic German living in Courland, a province of the Russian Empire that will soon become part of the country now known as Latvia. When the book opens, Viktor is 11 years old. Chapter 1, December 1905, Courland. My brother always said they were watching us, from the fields, or the forest, or roadside, wherever they did their chores. I never gave it much thought. He was the heir, and they were his concern. I, heir to nothing, could pardon watchfulness. What happened afterwards, though, even Jesus would not forgive. While our parents entertained the guests at the two-day Christmas ball inside, I sat on the manor steps that evening distributing glasses of champagne to late arrivals, well-wishers, and friends who'd enjoyed a walk in the crisp winter air of the Courland countryside. Unchaperoned for most of the night, I'd frankly had more than a few glasses myself, too much for an 11-year-old boy. It was in those later hours that I caught the voices on the wind. Far down the road, in the hollow, I could hear the singing of the working folk, those Latvians who spent their days farming the land for our family and the other Baltic barons. Their Christmas songs drifting between frost-covered fir trees, harmonies moving slowly along as unseen carolers passed through the night. Voices, it seemed, from another world, one that touched ours daily but remained forever closed. How I wished to understand those Lettish songs. With little to entertain me at the party, I got off the steps and found the old highway leading toward the peasant farms. Sipping champagne, by the time I reached the little thatch and log farmstead at which the carolers gathered, I was slightly cold, reasonably drunk, and completely surprised at the spectacle before me. And now please welcome Bill McCormick, who is on the line from Ukraine, ready to tell us what Viktor saw. Before we get to that, though, Bill, I'd like to hear a bit about your background. First of all, hello, and thank you for joining us.
Thank you very much for having me.
Where did you grow up?
I grew up in a little town called Boulder City, about 30 miles outside of Las Vegas. I was born in Maryland, but when I was 7 years old, moved out there, and that's still my home to this day, unless I'm in Europe, such as Ukraine now.
And how did you come to write fiction?
I've always been a storyteller, and I've always been very interested in writing fiction. I have a history of oral storytelling on stage. I've done it a couple of times in Washington, D.C. And I always liked the idea of taking the spoken story and putting it down on page.
And what were you doing before? I mean, you say that you did it on stage, which is really interesting. Was that part of your job, or was this a hobby that
No, completely a hobby. And It was just something that I did for because I enjoyed it. And I certainly didn't do it to any large audiences. Sometimes I was the only one in the room, practically. But I enjoy telling stories, and that's where the fiction writing comes from. It's a way of preserving your story, I suppose.
So what were you doing as a profession?
Well, I worked in the video game business and in the educational software business for many years. In the height of the dot-com world, I had my own company. And then I was working as a consultant in Washington, D.C., when the idea of writing this novel first came to me.
So tell me more about that. How did you get to writing? I mean, first of all, were you writing other things, or did you actually start with this novel? Was this your first big writing project?
This was my first big writing project. You know, I had a couple of short stories that I was playing around with, but I wanted to write a sort of a thriller novel initially, and I wanted to set it somewhere in Eastern Europe. And I sort of arbitrarily said, well, what about Latvia? And the Latvian Museum is in Rockville, Maryland, which wasn't too far from where I lived at the time. And I went there and I bought several books on Latvia. And the more I learned about the region, and specifically the Latvian riflemen and their roles in the Russian Revolution and their ultimate fate and the fate of their people, I was so moved that I sort of tore up the little thriller that I was going to write and decided to write a much more serious historical novel. And that's really where it came from, is the events of in this country at that time, I think nobody knows in the English-speaking world. And to me, it was such a powerful story that I just had to write it.
Yeah, I think that's fascinating. I would imagine that actually a lot of people are barely aware of where Latvia is and what it is. So you spent some time there, I understand, doing research.
Yes, yeah. I once the novel started really going, I realized that it was almost impossible at that time to get the proper information, the proper research done on this side of the Atlantic. So I moved to Riga. And lived there for 16 months researching the novel and journeyed to every place depicted in the book, talked to historians, talked to museum curators. In the later parts of the book, I even talked to descendants of people that were involved with the actual Latvian riflemen and in World War I and World War II to try to get a real feel for it and to turn it from an abstraction to something that I could really understand as a foreigner, or at least come as close as possible. And then I lived another year in Moscow, studied at Moscow State University, also to add my Russian, learn some more Russian, to get an understanding of Russian history and try to get a Russian perspective so that my book was a little more balanced. So yeah, it was a 3-year project, just researching and writing this book.
That's quite an investment of time. What was that like for you, going from Maryland to Latvia? Did you speak Latvian?
I took a few Latvian lessons, but not to any functional way. It was fascinating. You know, it was quite an experience. You land in a city in a country, you don't know anybody. I got myself an apartment in the center of the city, began to write and research. It was daunting, but incredibly fascinating at the same time. I can say it was one of the best experiences of my life. And when I began to talk to the Latvian people and what had happened in their country, you know, the people involved and the tragedies involved became very real. And I realized, you know, as I said, I'm a foreigner, but at least by living here, maybe I can impart my experiences back to the English-speaking world as accurately as possible.
Now, I have never been to Riga, but I do know about it a little bit because I am a specialist in the time of Ivan the Terrible, and Riga was then one of the great trading posts. Mm-hmm. But it's a very beautiful city in pictures. Is that your experience of it?
Gorgeous, absolutely. fantastic architecture, largest old town in the Baltics. It's a neat mixture of German, Russian, Swedish, and native Latvian sort of feel to it. It is a stunning place. If you haven't gone there, you must go there. It's great. And, of course, it has white nights and wonderful beaches in the summer, so you can't beat it. It's great.
That's great. So that brings us to your book. How did you go from this, 3 years of research is an enormous quantity of information. How did you go from there to distill it into the life of your hero, Viktor Rooks?
Well, that was the challenging part is, you do so much research and you spend so much time whittling it down into the best possible novel. Actually, editing the book took longer than writing the book. And, I chose the character of Viktor because he was a man that's sort of in the middle. He was he touches on all the major events of that period. And that's also why I chose to make it a novel, a work of historical fiction, rather than narrative nonfiction. By making my protagonist a fictional character, I could make sure that he was at all the key events, and I was at full sway to give my interpretations of events through his eyes. And I think that worked out really well. As I said, the character's sort of in the middle. He's a German aristocrat stuck between first Kaiser's Germany and then later Nazi Germany on one side, and first Tsarist Russia and then later the Soviet Union on the other side, between the landed classes of his birth and the revolutions, the various revolutions and social upheavals that took place in the first half of the 20th century. And so he's sort of like a cork on the water and bobbing around, pulled in all different sort of directions. And I thought that was interesting to try to give a perspective of a man who is not a great man, not some fantastic leader, but a man just trying to survive, who would interpret these events at the sort of ground level, where to him soldiers walking down the street were exactly that, soldiers walking down the street. It didn't necessarily mean anything more to him than that, other than as a way of trying to survive. But of course, as the novel progresses, he becomes more and more aware of what's happening in his world, and I hope that the reader will follow him as Victor's consciousness sort of expands.
Yeah, when we first meet him, as I will have mentioned in my introduction, he is 11 years old, and he is living in what is then the Imperial Russian province of Courland, which eventually becomes part of Latvia, right? And you mentioned that he's German. I think people may not... he's a Baltic German, is what he's known as to Russian specialists. But can you explain to people what that means, what his family is doing there?
Sure. His family is descended from crusaders who came to the area that is now Latvia, landed in Riga, 700 years earlier. And they were bringing Christianity to this area. And to sort of make a long story short, they were rewarded for bringing Christianity by land. And the people that they converted to Christianity, the native Latvians, basically became the serfs on their land. And over time, the descendants of these crusaders ended up as a sort of vassal state to the Russian Empire and paid their tributes back to the Russian Empire. So you had this situation at the turn of the 20th century where you had German overlords basically running the countryside for the Russian Empire, paying tributes to the Russian Empire, supported by the Russian army. And underneath this was the indigenous Baltic peoples, in this case the Latvians. And they had sort of a stratified society even more than other parts of the Russian Empire because of this. And in the beginning of the 20th century, you began to see a lot of nationalism and the birth of Latvian consciousness. And when you throw that in with all the other revolutions that were happening in 1905 throughout the Russian Empire, it began to sow the seeds of the later conflicts.
It's completely unfair, but I think if people have much sense of the Baltic Germans, it's possibly because they've seen the Sergei Eisenstein film Alexander Nevsky, and these are the guys riding around with big buckets on upside down on their heads and these wonderful horns and things coming out. And they're portrayed as the bad guys, although, of course, under the particularly under the later imperial system, you know, they were a fairly important part of the imperial order, these Courland Germans and Latvian Germans. And as a result, they became identified, in a sense, with the oppressors, I suppose.
Absolutely, absolutely. If you ask the average Latvian at that time who the oppressors were, they would say the Baltic Germans first, the Russians second, you know, because they were running these big estates, because they dominated the economies of the cities, such as Riga. And, you know, obviously from my character Victor's point of view, he's just doing what his family's always done. He's just begins the novel. He's just a youth on one of these landed estates. And he doesn't really know the Latvian people in any way, in any capacity other than as workers on his estates. And part of the novel, the character development of Victor is how he goes from perceiving them strictly as worker to friends and later actually falls in love with the Latvian woman.
So tell us, what does he see in that initial scene that I set up in the introduction?
He goes out into the woods and he sees the Latvian people, the term is mumming, through the night. And that is a tradition where they dress up in fantastic costumes and go sing songs in the wintertime, basically at the Christmas time. The tradition predates Christmas by long. It's really a pagan tradition, but it's come to be sort of equated as a holiday tradition in Latvia, and it's still performed today. Victor goes out and he sees these people. They're all dressed up. He can't identify them. He wonders, you know, are some of these my house servants? Are some of these the workers? Who these people be? And he doesn't know why they're doing it, but he's fascinated by it. And he finds it more interesting than sort of the stuffy aristocratic ball that his family is throwing for Christmas. And that's sort of the first step to show that Victor is more interested in the world around him than, say, some of his other people in his family or in his class. And then his brother, Otomars, he shows up and whisks Victor home because he's fearful that some of the Latvians might get drunk and do something, and there have been some problems. And that's the first hint to Victor that you know, everything's not ideal in the country that he lives in, that things could change. And that's sort of the difference between the two characters, is Victor is a man searching for something, while Otomars is a man that he views the world in a very realistic sort of way, almost to the point of later in his life evolving into an opportunist.
And that, I think we should call it a relationship, rather, to a sense it's a rivalry, because brothers or siblings in general do tend to have a rivalry, but there's a great love between Victor and Otomars also, and that's one of the two major relationships, I think, that runs through the novel.
Yes, absolutely. You know, it's a sibling rivalry, but also a very strong love. Otomars genuinely cares, of course, for his younger brother, and he mentors them, but they have a bit very and tries to protect him. In some ways, the main plot of the novel, other than the history behind it all, is Otomars trying to protect Victor. And but Victor, as his ideas begin to change, that puts him in conflict with the view of Otomars and what Otomars thinks Victor should be doing in life. And so you have this sort of big brother, little brother, realist versus what we'll call them less realist conflict going on. But at the heart, they're always brothers. And so whenever they have issues, you know, they try to get through it. But they're living at a time when the situation can divide brothers. And I think ultimately, to a certain extent, it does, without revealing too much of my plot.
Yes. And again, without giving away your ending, I have the sense that Victor's sense of himself as being always the younger brother, the one who's told what to do, the one who's never quite as on top of things, who's not as, I wouldn't say not as successful, but he's not successful in the same way. He's as Ottomar's. That's the internal, novels have external conflicts and yours has tons, but there's also the internal conflict and internal growth. That seems to be the central question that Victor is trying to resolve.
Yes, absolutely. You know, he is the second son, so to speak, and the world won't let him have his choice in life. You know, he wants to be an academic, but second sons in this era, they go into the military, and he ends up in the military. And so Ottomar's is, to some degree, a representation of what that world wants him to do, and to direct him into what to do. And Victor is weaker than Ottomar in some ways, and he has a hard time rebelling. But as the character grows, he begins to fight his brother's authority. Sometimes that works out for him well, and sometimes it doesn't. And that's sort of the initial conflict of when will Victor stand up to his brother and what will be the repercussions of him doing so.
So let's talk a little bit about, so Victor would like to be an academic, but he at least initially does not have that option. As you mentioned, he has to go into the military. And so he ends up fighting initially for the Tsarist forces against the forces of the Kaiser, who are ethnically the same as he is. He's German. So this immediately creates conflict for him because he's fighting with Russians and with Latvians against Germans, which doesn't, I think, bother him particularly because he identifies himself with the Russian Empire. But it does create a conflict between him and the forces around him.
Absolutely. He has a little bit of a conflict, but not a large one. Victor starts out as a conformist, and he's in the Russian army, and of course they're fighting the Germans, so he has to deal with that. But as you say, he's not trusted. He's not trusted by the Russian officers because they think he may want to go over to the other side or might be in communications with the other side. And he's very much not trusted by the Latvian officers because the Latvian officers at this point trust nobody. They don't trust the Kaiser's Germans, who are the enemy. They don't trust the Baltic Germans, who are the oppressors. And they don't trust the Russians, who are the overlords of the oppressors. So Victor is in a position where he's in an army, and there's a lot of dramatic conflict there because nobody trusts him and nobody trusts what his intentions are. And ironically, he's just trying to do what he views as the right thing. And the changing of trust actually is part of the themes of the book. Victor eventually earns the trust of the Latvians, and they begin to trust. He begins to trust them. They begin to trust him. At the same time, his trust in the old world, specifically the Tsarist regime and the Russian army, begins to erode. And then, of course, the question is: can you trust the Bolsheviks who come after them? And we sort of leave that open at that point.
Now, when we first meet him in 1905, Victor is 11. So by the time the war starts, he's still only 20, right? So he's very young as he goes into World War I. And I think one of the things that would be really interesting to bring out a little bit is that World War I has become kind of the forgotten war. It may change as the centennial of the war approaches next year. But it seems to be seen almost as a precursor to World War II at this point. And World War II was so devastating and so all-encompassing that World War I has almost been forgotten. And yet, in some ways, I think World War I was the much more pivotal moment for Europe, which had been largely peaceful since the Congress of Vienna in 1815.
I think you're right. A modern reader we tend to look at World War One almost as a, you say, precursor, almost as a prelude to World War Two. It's just the setup for what will happen in World War Two, which isn't, of course, I don't want to call it warfare, but that isn't historically the way you should really look at it. World War One, in many ways, was the beginning of the death of the old world. You know, it caused the destruction of the Russian Empire, the Hungarian Empire. I mean, everything began to fall apart. And you see that in the novel. At the beginning, you have these landed estates that aren't really all that different than the landed estates of, you know, 400 years before. And by the end of the First World War, everything is thrown into chaos. There's death on a level that could not have been conceived at that time. You know, you have these technological advances in weaponry, but the tactics hadn't matched it yet. The Americans found that in the American Civil War, where the tactics didn't match the technology, and you had massacres. Well, that happened to the Europeans in the First World War. And so there was this horrible fear, of course, that it could happen again. But in this case, I think it is the death of the old world, and specifically in the Russian Empire, because, of course, the Russian, the Bolshevik Revolution, and then the Russian Civil War followed, and it was the death of the Tsarist regime and the old world, much more than anybody could have predicted at the time. So, and Victor goes through all of that. So when you have all this fighting, supposedly for something new and something better, then you have expectations that those new ideologies and this new form of government will be beneficial, and that your sacrifice would not have been in vain. And that's the question Victor begins to ask himself: is there any purpose behind all of this?
Well, there are also other features of World War One, which I think made it in some ways a particularly devastating war. It's the first time where you really encounter trench warfare, which was, it's one thing to be on a horse waving your saber, dashing at something, even if it's into the teeth of the Turkish guns, as with the charge of the Light Brigade. It's something else to sit in a trench, you know, with mud up to your knees day after day after day, waiting for the mustard gas and the bullets that, may hit you, or, you know, grenades to fall in among you and so on. It's a different, maybe it's not a different way. Maybe it was always that way for the infantry, and the difference is that there were more infantry. But you do get the sense of World War One that it was a new experience of warfare in some ways.
Surely, strictly in war terms, yeah, of course. You mentioned the trench warfare. That was the development. Of course, mustard gas. I mean, so many things: tanks, airplanes, zeppelins. All these came. In particular, to this novel, the Germans fighting the Latvian riflemen had to develop a new form of warfare called the light beam warfare. The Blitzkrieg was invented to push the Latvian riflemen out of Riga.
Oh, really? I wasn't aware of that.
Yeah, and that was the first time it was ever used in mass, when the Latvian riflemen were finally pushed out of Riga. And that, of course, is the great innovation at the beginning of the Second World War, the Germans with their Blitzkrieg warfare. So you can see what's coming, and also you get to... You get the beginning, the use of smaller unit tactics. You know, at the beginning, without going on about warfare forever, at the beginning of these wars, you would have an officer telling somebody to fire at a certain angle at a certain time. And as the weapons got quicker and reload rates got faster, soldiers became more independent, relatively speaking, of their commanders. And this fit in with some of the ideas that were going on in terms of the lower class, the common soldier, having more autonomy, just like the common worker should have more autonomy. And there's a parallel there. And I think it's touched on in the novel, but certainly you can sort of feel it.
For Latvia in particular, this must have been a very ambiguous or ambivalent time, because on one hand, it Latvia was a battlefield, essentially, throughout the entire period of your novel. Not always literally shooting, but, you know, it was a constant... it was in the middle of constant struggle, mostly between Russia and Germany for control. And yet, there was this short period of independence. Could you talk a little bit about that? Because I'm not sure that's really familiar to most of the people who will be listening.
Sure. Latvia became independent of Russia, coming Soviet Russia, in 1921, and was independent for almost 20 years until it was reoccupied by Stalin Soviet Union. And that was quite a nice time. I mean, the economy worked very well. It was backed by the British and the Americans, who wanted to make sure that they had free states between the Soviet East, that they had a buffer zone. And it had a very nice economy. And as a matter of fact, when the Soviets occupied Latvia for a second time, the Americans and the British never recognized that occupation. So technically, even though Latvia became part of the Soviet Union and the Russians put up a puppet government, the United States never recognized Latvia's inclusion into the Soviet Union. That time was the first time in their history that the Latvians had their own country in the 20s and 30s. They'd always been under either the Russians or the Germans or the Swedes, to some extent the Poles and the Lithuanians. And for them, it was really a time for producing their own art, their own self-identity. And so that by the time the Soviets came back in 1940, there was no doubt that Latvia would be a very difficult place to occupy. And as a matter of fact, I read a poll of Soviet officers in the 1980s of what was the greatest threat to the Soviet Union. It wasn't the United States or Afghanistan. The number one was Latvia. And the Latvians didn't want to be part of the Soviet Union. And that sort of militancy comes back to how they retreated and what happened to them during the second occupation, which is depicted at the end of the book.
Now, that moment of independence is also part of Victor's story. But before we get there, I'd like to invite you, if you have a particular passage from the book that you'd like to read it. But also, I would like to talk, either in context of that excerpt or afterwards, about how Victor gets from being in the Tsarist army in World War I to supporting Lenin in 1917 and 1918. So I'm going to turn it over to you and let you decide what you want to do with that.
All right. Well, I'll explain how he gets to support the Bolsheviks first, I guess, and then I'll go to the passage. Victor is put into the Russian army, and he loses everything he has prior to this in the failed revolution of 1905. His family loses everything to a failed Latvian rebellion. So he's very antagonistic towards the Latvian ethnicities, even though they are part of the same army as him. And he's basically sent to a battalion of Latvians to spy on them to see if there are any people that are considering a Latvian nation, or anybody that's being tempted by the Bolsheviks and similar sort of revolutionary groups. As he does so, though, being part of this Latvian battalion, he begins to slowly view the Latvians less as workers, but more as equals. He becomes tentative friends with several of the other officers. He sees one that's highly capable, in fact, is obviously more capable than himself, and he begins to ponder that. And then, of course, they are treated very poorly by the Russian officers and the Russian superiors. The moment that really sort of changes Victor, besides the sort of building friendships, is what's called the Christmas Battles, and that's in late 1916, early 1917, December 1916, January 1917. these were an offensive against the Kaiser's Germans in Latvia. Red Latvian battalion opened up a 7 kilometer opening in the German lines. And they pushed back the Germans considerably. And what had been, as you had mentioned, trench warfare, it had been a long time of just sitting there. Now they had opened up the lines. And during this massive offensive, the Russians, the Siberian Corps that was supposed to support the Latvian battalion, refused to enter the battle. And so the Latvians got no support. And so this great offensive where they had pushed the Germans back ground to a halt, and the Latvians barely got back to their own land, own lines, and lost 9,000 men. And at that point, it sort of dawns on Victor that the Russians aren't really willing to die for this land. The only people that are willing to die for the land that he was born in are the Latvians themselves. And he begins to have a lot of empathy and sympathy for them, and begins to look at the Russians just like he looks at the Kaiser's Germans as foreign powers that are abusing his homeland. And that puts him in league with the Latvians. And ultimately, the Bolsheviks, sensing that the Tsar's army had treated the Latvians so poorly, and yet the Latvians have been so innovative, comes to them and says to the Latvians, we want you to start the Red Army, and we want to put you ahead of the Russians. And Victor, even though he never really supports communism, he does support friendship. And so he's sort of pulled along with his friends. Plus, the country's in such chaos that the only place he can survive is in an armed unit. That's the only way you can live. And so he goes where he has friends. And that puts him, ironically, this landed German aristocrat, in what's called Lenin's harem, which was the Latvian riflemen that were closest to Lenin and ultimately guarded the Kremlin. And so you find this German aristocrat, by hook or by crook, ends up guarding the Kremlin, supporting the communists when he was first put in the army to hunt communists. And I like that irony and that twist of fate.
Mm-hmm. Yes, it very much captures, I think, not just the sense of the book, but also the sense of the history. I mean, that this kind of thing is happening, that where people can begin, so much is going on outside that is catching people up in these grand world events, that you can begin as a supporter of the Tsar and you can end up as an old Bolshevik, in effect, which is what ultimately happens to many of the riflemen and to all of the communists in the period who were the original supporters of the revolution. I won't go further than that because I don't want to get into Victor's own fate. I think people should read the book to find that out.
Yes.
But did you have a passage that you would like to read? And then we'll talk about what happens to Victor after the war.
Yeah, sure. The passage that I had planned on reading was actually after the war.
So maybe we should talk about that first then. So after the war, and after being a Red Rifleman and a member of Lenin's harem, which is a wonderful title, although it's a little inappropriate since the harem is usually the people inside, not the people guarding the outside, but, whatever. I don't mean that it's inappropriate for you to have used it. I mean that it's an odd expression in and of itself. I assume it comes from the period in question, right?
Yeah, it was a sort of derogatory term. It's very obscure. I only found it in one or two history books when I was reading it back in Riga. And I thought, oh, what an interesting, unusual thing. And it was a derogatory term, meaning these men were always around Lenin. They were subservient to Lenin. The Latvian riflemen would not have liked being called Lenin's harem. And I mentioned it only once or twice in the book, and I think even then they're not saying it in a proud way. But I like the irony in that, a harem, the master of a harem may profess love, but he's really just using these women. I think Lenin and the Bolsheviks, promised the Latvian riflemen many things, but as we know in Stalin's purges, they were discarded when they weren't used, needed either. So I thought there was a terrible ironic parallel there.
No, I agree. Absolutely. It's a great title for starters. And in addition to that, it is, as you say, it really does capture the relationship between Lenin and the Latvian riflemen in a way that is perhaps uncomfortable for both sides, but nonetheless appropriate. Or at least it's understandable the way that you put it. I'm glad that you explained it.
Oh, okay. Great.
So after the war, and after having been a member of Lenin's harem, Viktor returns to Riga, and at this point he falls in love with a woman named Kaiva, who is herself Latvian, and this upsets his family no end. Can you tell us about her and what it is about her that bothers Viktor's family, and then why he sticks with her, because he does, despite everything, and certainly despite his family's opposition.
Sure. Kaiva is a Latvian woman. She is the younger sister of another Latvian rifleman that Viktor served with, and he got to meet her through him. She and her family were displaced during the First World War, and so they've returned to Riga without any money, and so the character of Kaiva has sort of reevaluated how she views the world. And she's an ardent communist. She sort of believes in idealized communism, the sort of communism where everyone is equal and everything is shared, and less about bloody revolutions and less about, getting rid of the aristocrats, and more about the concept of equality. And more about the concept of equality for women that was also coming out at that time through communism and in Latvia in particular as well. What Viktor finds attractive to her is that, this is a woman who can support herself, who has a cause, who doesn't need him. She might love him, but she doesn't need him. And in his prior world, the world of, sort of Baltic aristocrats, the women that he met were concerned with much narrower range, not necessarily their faults, it's the fault of their society, but that was his experience. Meet a man, have children, talk about decorating the house, and this was a woman that is not only his intellectual equal, but far more driven than he is, and that he finds that exciting, and he finds her different and challenging, and their relationship continues. And of course, yes, as you mentioned, the family is terrified because not only is she a Latvian, the people that through their revolution took everything Viktor's family had, but she's a communist, an ardent communist, and an unapologetic communist. And so he sticks with her basically because he is truly in love with her, because the character shows him aspects of himself that he never dreamed. When the relationship begins to sour towards the end of the book, and I won't give you the reasons why, he still is so in love that he feels that this is, in his own way, the sacrifice that he must make to stay with her. And I don't really want to extrapolate on that too much more, so I want to let the readers keep it up to interpretation. But there's also a parallel between Viktor and Kaiva's relationship and what was happening to the country of Latvia and at the time. And without turning it into an allegory, there are some parallels there that I also really like about the character. But she just is such a strong character. And of course, Audemars is at the polar opposite. And Kaiva believes absolutely in communism no matter what happens. And Audemars believes in nothing, to the point of being becoming, he isn't always that way, but becoming an opportunist. And Viktor is in between these two more powerful personalities who pull him back and forth.
Yeah, I was thinking of that as I was listening to you speak, because I hadn't specifically noticed the almost parallel, really. I mean, Kaiva and Audemars are at opposite poles, as you say, but in some ways their relationship with Viktor is similar.
Yes, they both kind of dominate him, truthfully, and They are both trying to pull him into their own worldviews, while Victor is trying to still discern his worldview. And you had mentioned the ending. That also is what's happening. Victor, for better or for worse, finally makes a decision, really, that is his own. And throughout this novel, he's pulled and dragged by forces greater than him, whether it's his wife or his brother, or whether it's an army here or there, or an ideology here or there. But finally, at the end of the book, and that's why I do feel it's not ambiguous and has some closure, Victor finally stands up. Now, the ramifications of that sort of standing up and making those decisions were left to guess, but I think most readers can figure out what will happen.
Yeah, I had that same reaction, actually. I did hear an earlier interviewer mention that the ending was ambiguous, and I really didn't find it ambiguous because that inner story is resolved. And the outer story, it's hard to know, to be honest, given the situation in Latvia at that time, what possibilities there were. I mean, even if you had ended it quite differently, the reality is that, well, first of all, outer stories are always ambiguous, except in fairy tales. There is no happy ever after ending. Something is resolved, but then, you know, life goes on, even for characters, and new problems emerge. But more fundamentally, I think it would have been less true to the situation if there had been... I mean, the only thing really would be if he got on a boat to somewhere where life was better, I suppose. But and maybe he does that, I won't say. but I think as long as that inner journey is resolved, then the book is resolved. There is no real ambiguity as to Victor's character and the fact that he has grown throughout the book.
Yeah, I think your perceptions are spot on there. Thank you. Yeah, his personal journey, we have closure, you know, but what was going on in that world at that time, Latvia was between Nazi Germany and Stalinist Soviet Union. You're talking times of lesser evil, of a lot of uncertainty. So to give it a nice, tidy ending in terms of the external things would not really reflect those times at all. You know, this we end the book. The war is, Second World War is really in the middle. It's really sort of in the beginning, and Latvia as a country wouldn't become a country again for another. I'm trying to do the math off the top of my head, but you know, 1989, 1990, 1991, so you know, 50 years. So yeah, I think trying to give it some sort of either Hollywood, you know, everything works out fine ending, or just making it a tragic ending wouldn't necessarily work either. So I like that ending, but as we said, there's a lot of closure, I think.
Yeah, no, I think there is. I mean, these two colossal forces are just about to clash on Latvian territory. So it's not going to be good whether one individual or another individual survives. The country is about to be a war zone again.
Again. And, you know, towards the end of the book, Victor asked that question, you know, for after all the sacrifice, all the wars, all the new engineering, new ideologies and ways of living, you know, foreign powers are burning my country again. And that is part of his ideological evolution. That is his country, and Latvia is his country. He's not a German living in Latvia. He's not a Russian living in Latvia. He's not ethnically a Latvian, but this is his place in the world. And that, too, is an evolution of the character.
So we're coming to the end of our time. Would you like to read the passage before we move on to what you're doing now?
Sure. I will read a short passage. A little preface. In the second Soviet occupation of Latvia in 1940, the Soviet army took away all the important people in the country and put them in prison. This included the intelligentsia, the old religious leaders, military leaders, anybody that anyone listened to, basically, they could put on trains. And Victor himself finds that despite his service in the former Soviet Army, and perhaps just because of that, he and Kaiba have now been put on a prison train. And so this is an excerpt from that part of the book. As the train began to move, panic swept the car. People pawed their bodies, dug deep into pockets for anything, no matter how small, to write upon. Fought over pens, chalk, lead pencils, desperate to scribble a note for families, lovers, and friends. More than farewells, they recorded practical information, the train, the hour, the station. No one could honestly say where we might be going. Packed near me was a young Latvian officer, the insignia and buttons absent from his uniform. Even stripped of the fasteners of his trousers, he had bunched them up into a knot to keep them out. Falling against me as the car vibrated, he quickly unwrapped a cigarette, tore the paper in half, handing the remnant to a neighbor for writing his own in the tiniest of letters. Please deliver this to 6971 Gertrudis Ilija on a train leaving Saturday from Tornkalnis station. Tell Liva Kukina I love her and will hold her again. Lieutenant Felix Mahones. All over the car, they shoved these notes through gaps in the windows, in the planks or past the bars. Between the boards, I could see the fluttering papers, hundreds, maybe thousands, trailing along the train as it gained speed, like a huge swarm of white butterflies floating, spinning in the air, hovering above every car, finally dropping behind, unable to match the engine's acceleration. I thought to join them to add my own message, but by then there was no paper remaining. Every cigarette, wrapping, clothing tag, or book leaf had been sacrificed. And truthfully, the only person I really wanted to contact was herself, almost uncertainly, on another car or train like me journeying into the unknown. I think that's all. I'll keep that short.
Thank you. I think that really captures the book, and I hope that people will look it out and read it, because the whole book, I will tell them, is filled with descriptions like that. It really takes us into the trenches and into the war, and then into the experience of freedom, and then this new oppression that follows the purges of 36-38, which we also talked about with Jay Wachtel, who shares a publisher with you, in his novel Stalin's Witnesses. One more question about Lenin's harem before we go on. What would you like readers to take away from the novel? Is there anything that we haven't spoken about that you think is really important for people to hear?
I really wanted to just illuminate people to, you know, what happened in this part of the world, because, like you said, it's sort of overlooked by a lot of people, at least in the English-speaking world. And there's so many stories, both heroic and tragic. The story of the Latvian riflemen, you know, they start, here you have this little country, and yet they eventually play to a certain extent kingmakers for the Soviet Union, what would become the Soviet Union, you know, the largest country on earth. And and then how were they rewarded, and how were their people rewarded? So, you know, what happens when you defend totalitarian regimes? I think that's something to be taken from. But also, you know, I think hopefully it's a universal story about a man just trying to find his place in this universe, trying to deal with the conflicts thrown upon him, and you know, the question of lesser evil once again has raised its head. So, but mainly I would hope that people would learn a little bit about this part of the world and the Latvians and the Latvian riflemen and what happened there, and hopefully learn it in a way that is entertaining to them. Because, you know, people tend to shy away from history books these days. So if you can write it in a way that is interesting and gripping, then maybe you can sneak in the learning underneath. So, but I hope so.
Yeah, well, it was a very pleasant learning. So I agree with you. I think that's a great thing for people to take from the novel and to seek in the novel. People may not realize this, but we are talking to you in Ukraine from Philadelphia, and the gods of the internet have been kind, and for all I know, you could be next door. But what are you doing in Ukraine?
I am working on another novel. It's set in Odessa, and it's less serious. It is a mystery novel about two sisters in turn of the 20th century Odessa who think that they may have discovered the murderer that is plaguing the city. And they follow him down into the catacombs under Odessa, which are the largest catacombs in the world. And it's sort of a mystery adventure that takes place under that. And it's primarily the book that I'm writing in Ukraine. And I'm also editing another book that's related to Lenin's harem called The Second Siege, which is about Latvian revolutionaries in the early 1900s who financed revolution in Russia, in Latvia, by robbery in London. And they used to rob jewelry stores and things like that to pay for weapons and books. And it's based on a true story. And they ultimately get involved with everybody from the Tower of London guards to Winston Churchill. So that book is in the editing stages, and I'm still working on the more mystery novel set in Odessa. That's in the drafting stages right now.
Oh, great. We look forward to reading the new books and perhaps talking to you again at some point.
Thank you very much for having me, Carolyn.
Oh, well, thank you so much for sharing your time with us, Bill. And thank you for listening to our podcast. I am C.P. Leslie, host of New Books in Historical Fiction, and today I've been talking with William Burton McCormick, author of Lenin's Harem. You can find out more about him and his book at www.leninsharem.com. That's L-E-N-I-N-S-H-A-R-E-M as one word. Goodbye for now, and please join us next month for another conversation about new books in historical fiction.